On this edition of the Scott Radley Show podcast, we are going to be talking about area rating. Doesn't sound very exciting, but wait till you see how it affects your tax bill. You'll find it exciting all of a sudden. We're going to be talking about the Blue Jays, who made a huge trade and are now seemingly the favorites in the American League. At least a lot of people are saying so. Mike Wilner will join us from Florida. And we're going to talk to the father of Jude Strickland, the young boy who was hit by a truck and killed about a little more than a year ago. His dad joins us, and it is a remarkable story. He is a remarkable guy. It's a remarkable family. You are going to want to take a listen. Stick around.
Today on the Scott Radley Show on 900 CHML.
So area rating is back up for discussion, it seems. Specifically, the elimination of area rating. For those who have heard the term maybe and don't know really what it means, essentially, in the simplest possible terms, different wards in town, people in different wards pay different amounts on their taxes for different services. There are some things that are combined or that are across the board, but others, there's changes. This would eliminate that. And this came up at a council meeting on March the 3rd in a budget committee meeting when Brad Clark suggested that this should be gotten rid of over a decade. Others have said, no, it should be way faster than that. We got to get rid of this faster. So the argument is that some would make that it's essential to really grow the city. Others say getting rid of this is going to be unfair since parts of our city don't have equal access to certain services. Therefore, they shouldn't pay the same for them. You get the complication of this stuff. The city is broad and big, and different places have different things. Well, at the top of the list for what would be affected, public transit. I want to bring in Ward 8 Councillor John Paul Danko, who joins us now. Councillor, thank you for the time today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
So this was brought up in the meeting, and then this has been written about. And then I saw that on Twitter, you had some comments about this. If I could interpret your words, you're a proponent, I would guess, of getting rid of area rating.
Yeah, area rating has been with the city of Hamilton since amalgamation, so for more than 20 years. And the last time we did a little bit of work on it was back in 2011. There was some reevaluation. But not a whole lot of change. So this is something that is long due to finally, I think, solve and put to bed once and for all. It is divisive because it deals with money. And I think everybody thinks that their taxes are too high. And, you know, nobody wants to pay for services that they don't use or see as a benefit. So it's understandable that it causes, quite a bit of consternation and debate. But we have been one city for 22 years, and, it's about time that we finally deal with this head on.
I don't know if it's the biggest, I think it probably is. Transit is certainly at the forefront of this because not just because it's a lot of money that we pay for transit, but because this city really does have different, transit availability. If you're downtown, you get a lot of availability for transit. If you're in the suburbs or way out in the rural areas, you don't. That's going to be difficult as a selling point, I would think. If you're living out in Flamborough and the bus comes along every 2 hours or whatever it is, compared to someone who may be living on the LRT line, to tell those people they should pay the same, boy, that's going to be a hard sell.
Yeah, area rating for transit is kind of the biggest one. If we were to spread the cost of area of transit throughout the entire city equally, the residents of wards 1 to 8, so the old city of Hamilton, would see about a 3% tax decrease, saving them about $111 a year on their taxes, and the residents in those rural wards would pick up the difference, which is a pretty big significant shift. Now, I don't think, that's not really fair because those areas don't receive any transit. But there has been significant changes to transit boundaries over the years as our city's grown and as we've grown into some of those former municipalities that previously didn't have transit service but desperately need expansion to those areas. And the current area rating for transit system is really holding back those investments because those areas that aren't area rated for transit, don't receive transit, so it's not used, and they're not paying the same amount as currently the residents in the old city of Hamilton pay for transit.
And just to follow up on the amount you said, so the main part of the city, the old city of Hamilton, the average person would get about $111 off their taxes. In Ancaster, you would add $350, in Flamborough, add $327. Glanbrook add 252 to your taxes. So, but here's the thing I'm not quite getting on this one. And that is, one of the arguments for this has been, all right, if we do this, there will be more money put into the pot. So some of those areas that right now don't have great transit would be able to get a better transit system. But if we're dropping the price for some and increasing it for other, are we not just keeping the pot the same? Like, where's the, why would this mean a better system?
What we're talking about right now in terms of area rating is it's meant to be revenue neutral. So it's not new income for the city of Hamilton through taxes. It's reassessing who pays what and which areas pay. So I think the transit one is sort of the extreme example if it was spread evenly. I don't think that that's fair. I don't think the rural areas, you know, that don't have transit at all should pay for transit. And that's one of the things that is sort of part of the discussion. But there are areas in, you know, upper and lower Stony Creek where we do need to expand transit in Dundas and Ancaster and Waterdown that currently aren't area rated for transit but do need an expansion of the service. And we really can't do that unless we change the payment system.
But could, even if you were going to expand into those areas, let's say in you know, the outskirts of Ancaster or whatever, Dundas, whatever else, and you were going to add, if it's going to be a neutral thing, would you not have to take buses away from the old city in order to put the buses into those areas to keep it neutral? Or would the city regardless be paying more for transit?
Well, under the current recommendations and what we're looking at now, again, area rating is revenue neutral, so it's not new money. But I think it provides us a baseline, you know, to rebalance where things are paid for and who pays for what. And then we can have that discussion from that baseline of where we need to reinvest in service.
One thing that we know, and look, you're on council, you're finishing, this is your first term, right? I haven't forgotten, right? This is your first term of council.
Well, it's COVID. We all forget what day of week it is.
Yeah, I know. It's okay. So, but my point is not just because of that, but you watched council for a long time, even before you got on. So you're not someone who's been on for life and, you know, you live in a bubble. You've seen things. You understand that in this city, we have for a long time had a lot of arguments between the lower city and the upper city, the suburbs and the urban areas and this kind of thing. Is this not going to simply create more of that we're not looking at? Some people will argue, well, you or other councillors, you're not really looking out for the betterment of the whole city. You're looking out for your ward because your ward is going to get a tax saving and therefore, hey, that's good news for the people who are going to vote for me. Is this something that will make us get along better or just create more fights?
Well, I mean, politically, the urban councillors do have a majority on council, so we could put the hammer down on this tomorrow, you know, if we wanted to, but I don't think that that's fair, and we don't want to do that. We want to be able to phase this in over time and have a systematic and thoughtful way to reevaluate who pays for what. And I think it's important to note that area rating is not pay for use. So the argument can't be that because I don't use it, I shouldn't pay for it. We all pay for services that we might not necessarily use. For example, recreation centers, or, you know, I don't golf, but I pay for municipal golf courses and things like that. So, yes, like I said off the top, you know, it is divisive because it has to do with money. But overall, again, you know, we're one city, and area rating just, you know, sort of perpetuates that divisiveness term after term, year after year.
This is not going to be, people can listen for area rating coming up in future city council meetings, because I'm quite positive this is going to be talked about again, picked up again, I guess. It's always been out there, but picked up again. Councillor John Paul Danko, thank you for the time today. Appreciate it.
No problem. Thanks for having me on.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
I am quite sure that if you live in this city, you know and are familiar with the story of Jude Strickland. He was the 11-year-old Hamilton boy who was struck and killed by a pickup truck driver who was speeding and had drugs in the truck and had 9 Highway Traffic Act violations on his record. This was back in December of 2020. Well, the case was back in court this week for a pre-sentence hearing. And it is, say, you're familiar with this, you understand, it is heartbreaking. Anyone with a child could probably try to imagine what it might be like to go through this. Someone who knows, though, exactly what it's like to go through this is Jude's dad, Jamie, who joins me now. Jamie, thanks for taking the time today. Really appreciate this.
Yeah, hi, no problem.
This has to be, I would guess, bringing all this up again, having to go back to court and everything else this week. I'm guessing this is probably a very difficult week for your family.
Yeah, for sure. Yesterday when we were in online court, I guess it was a very emotional and exhausting day. Kind of just brings our memories back to losing Jude and just all the, just everything afresh. So it has been a hard last day or so.
I mean, I say this respectfully, thankfully, I've never gone through what you've had to go through. And I think that most people probably feel very fortunate that they haven't. I imagine every week, every day is tough. Does it get any less tough as time goes on?
I think yes and no, I guess you could say, because in the immediate hours and days and weeks following Jude's death, it was just a blur. It was a fog. Everything was hard. And then, as time goes on, slowly, the deep hurt and the freshness of the wound, I guess, heals. But there's still constant daily reminders that he's not with us, and the hole that is left in our family and in our hearts. And so, some grief definitely comes in waves that are unexpected. Sometimes, it's at things that just as we're driving, we hear ambulance sirens in the background, and it just brings us back to that day. Or I see someone else speeding when I'm driving, and it really hurts me to the core, thinking that it was the same type of recklessness that happened on that day that caused Jude's death. And so, there's regular reminders, but again, in some ways, time does heal the hardness, I guess, of day to day moving on, I guess.
I'll tell you a big reason that I wanted to have Jamie on today, and it's for something a little bit unique, because there are families who come to court for the sentencing or for the hearing of those who've harmed loved ones, and they are enraged and seeking some kind of vengeance from the courts. And look, I've not been in their shoes, and I'm not judging them for their feelings. Until you've been there, who knows how you might think or act. You, though, Jamie, and your family, I've been so interested and so amazed by your family's reaction. You've not been like that, not outwardly anyway. Why not?
I can definitely understand why people would feel the way they feel. I do have times where I feel anger and hatred, for sure. One of the things that's really held us in this time in the past year and a bit has been our faith. And we're following the teachings that we truly believe that Jesus has taught us to forgive those who have done things against you, and to love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. And I've just seen that is a better way than trying to hold anger and resentment as a way forward in life. And one way I think of it is failing to forgive is like drinking poison and hoping that it harms the other person. And I just have seen how in smaller instances, how people who fail to forgive have just been bitter and resentful, and it's harmed the rest of their life. Whereas I think it's way more freeing and a way to move forward in a more healthy way is to seek rather as much as possible, and it is a struggle to forgive and move forward in that way.
I was going to say, I was glad you added that last bit, because I have to believe that, saying that and wanting to do that is one thing, but actually doing it, I imagine there's times when it must be very difficult to do that.
Oh, 100%. And I believe, and I think sometimes what I've learned about forgiveness is that it's granted before it's felt. And so you have to, sometimes we wait till we feel something in order to say it is, but instead we have to forgiveness is something that we give to someone, and then we can slowly move forward and begin to feel it and realize and actualize it in our experience. But it is, you know, it 100% is hard. It's not easy. When you forgive, forgiveness requires a debt, and it's either going to be paid by you in your forgiveness or by the other person. And so I think, it does cost something, but I think it also frees us to live in a more healthy way moving forward. And that's what we want to model. Like, that's what we're taught to do, from our faith, but it's also something that we want to model to our family, to our remaining boys. We still have three awesome sons that we still have, and we want them to see us living out our faith in real life in ways that shows that it's not just a Sunday activity that is kind of meaningless in the other 6 days of your life, but it's actually the best way to live, and we truly believe that.
And again, it's so unique in a circumstance like this, and that's why I find it so fascinating. But even what you're saying, do you feel like a forgiving person, or have you simply said, I'm deciding that I will forgive regardless of how it feels?
I think that's how the second part of what you said is how we definitely start. And I just need to choose to forgive. But it, as I live it out now, it just feels right, even though it's hard. So I guess if everything in life was that was right was easy, we would all be always doing the right things. But often doing what's right is the hardest thing to do. And that's just what we've made a decision to do, because we do think it's right. It's good for us. It's good for society if more people forgave and held less bitterness. But like the debt, in some ways, the debt can never be repaid, right? Like the debt that Mr. Aubert has toward us because of what he did, he can never repay that. So in a sense, if we're just going to live the rest of our life saying, well, I'm going to hate him until he repays the debt, well, it's just impossible. And so that's where it just remains on us. How are we going to choose to live now, holding on to this debt that can never be repaid and expecting it to be repaid, or forgiving it as best we can day by day and seeking to make the most of the rest of our lives, and hoping that in many ways that enables him to make the most of the rest of his life. And, you know, it would just be our hope and prayer for him that he would turn his life around, from some of the things you mentioned at the beginning, could be a positive member of society moving forward.
Yeah. I mean, look, it's so difficult even to ask this next question because, again, none of us have been there. But when you're talking about this, and forgiveness is such a heavy word and a loaded word, when you were watching the proceedings yesterday and you saw him, do you feel the same way today after making the decision to forgive as you did back then? Or like, how do you look at him?
You know, in some ways it'll be different if on April 5th, when the actual sentencing happens, we're in person. In some way, it's hard to process some of these things just over Zoom, where you see another individual on a little box on your screen through pixels and that. I think it'll be a lot different and perhaps harder. And we plan on attending the sentencing, and we do hope it's in person so that I think it will help us with some sense of closure. Yeah, it's been hard for the past year where we didn't even see or know who this person was. And as we slowly get to know about his character and some of those things, in some ways it made a difference. But in other ways, it's still just that decision. And the bigger thing for us isn't the pound of flesh that you know, you think we would want or something, but it's more, We've lost Jude, and it's almost too much to, like, so much of our emotion and our day-to-day life is losing him, but also hoping to make, in order to make Jude's life even go beyond his 11 years, is helping live out some of the principles that we saw in his life in those 11 years, which is kindness, which is showing love for other people. And if we all of a sudden just, in the greatest tragedy, when it perhaps means the most, become totally different people or live in a way that wouldn't honor Jude's life or the faith that we, our Christian faith that we proclaim to live, it would just kind of be meaningless, and it would almost harm Jude's legacy and our own faith. So in a sense, we make the decision in some ways based on what we know is right, and then we trust that our feelings will slowly follow moving forward, but knowing that that is the best and most healthy way for us moving forward.
Jamie, I have to believe that over the last year and 3 months, whatever it is, that you've probably heard that from people too. You've probably had people coming up to you and saying, how can you possibly do that?
A little bit, I guess. Sometimes people don't really know what to say when they talk to us, or they feel kind of uncomfortable to talk about, just because they don't want to upset us or that. But it's hard to know how anyone would respond in a specific situation. And obviously, we didn't know how we would respond. We were never obviously expecting something like this to happen to us. But we have really felt like that it's not people. We haven't been walking alone in this. And in many ways, I don't know how someone would go through this without the community, the family of at our church at West Highland that have walked with us very closely in this, provided for us help. We felt like we've been carried with them by them practically, but also we constantly are hearing people, you know, we're thinking of you guys, we're praying for you. And we know that we're being empowered by the prayer of people who really do care for us.
There is a question, and look, I've asked you a bunch of difficult questions already. This one, I don't know if you have an answer for this, but it's a question that comes up when things happen at times, and that is, why do bad things happen to good people? You're living this right now. Have you come up with an answer for that question personally?
In some ways, I don't know that I'm okay. I think we're all people who struggle with different things, so. But I get what you're saying. We believe that, and we trust in a God who is sovereign, who knows the beginning from the end. And so from this, we've had to trust that even if we don't understand the reason why, that God has had a purpose in this. And as Christians though, as well, we don't believe that, that December the 1st, and then when he eventually passed on the 3rd, was the end for Jude. One of the things that keeps us going is the fact that we truly believe that Jude is happier at this moment than he's ever been before, as he's in heaven. And one day we will go again to be with him. And so our hope is that we will get to see him again, and we will rejoice with him. And again, that's not just a quaint thought that, you know, looks good on a bumper sticker or something. Like we actually believe that we will see him again. If this life was all that there is, then it would be even that much more devastating. But we miss Jude now 100%, but we do trust that we will see him again.
You've mentioned a couple times that you are a pastor. Have you ever had to, prior to this, had you ever counseled someone who, obviously not the exact same circumstance, but had you ever sat down and counseled someone who had gone through some sort of horrible loss?
Not to this degree for sure. But for going through something like this has increased my empathy for other people going through things in a way that I would have never understood before. At the beginning, it was very hard when I would hear people complain about their days or their circumstances, and you have to learn to not play a comparison game whereby someone says they're having a bad day because, you know, they broke their coffee mug or something. It's just like, okay, yeah. Well, I just lost my son, right? Like, you just can't live in that space. But I do have a lot more empathy for people who do struggle with loss or just different things in their lives, because I know how much, you know, everyone you meet is going through something. And so sometimes we don't understand people's responses to certain things, but we just don't know what they're going through. And so I think generally this has helped me become a more empathetic person, even if I don't know what they're going through, because everyone's going through something. It may not have been as big or as bad as what Vanessa and I have gone through, but for them, it's big and it can affect their day. So it has helped me overall become a more empathetic and hopefully caring person.
Just before I let you go, because we are short on time, I wish we could talk about this for a few hours, because I think it's that important. But just in the time we have, you mentioned that people don't know what to say. And I think that's, you know, if nothing else, we don't know what to say when something like this happens to someone, whether it's something as tragic as this or even someone's parent dying. I think most people have no idea what they're supposed to say to try and make someone else feel better. You've been on the side of it now where you've been getting the comments directed to you, the good ones and probably the ones that you roll your eyes, honestly, at a few of them. What is the thing that someone or some people have said to you that has actually helped?
Right. Yeah. Well, we could take a whole nother show on this one. Which I'm open to, but to helping people with this, but there's a few things. You can't necessarily cause harm by asking about the person. So I appreciate it when people ask questions like, tell me about Jude. It's meaningful to be able to tell people about you. And that's why even, you know, today, why I suggest even come on the show, just to share about Jude, share about our hope. So asking questions about the loved one that they've lost is helpful. I think immediately following the tragedy, we had about, you know, thousands of people probably literally saying, if you need anything, just let me know. And that's a nice thought, but it's not super practical. It's what's very helpful is sending a text, hey, I'm at the grocery store. Do you need anything that I can bring over? When there's like very concrete things, like I'm willing to bring you a meal on Thursday night, it just makes it a yes or no for someone in the middle of their grief. But just kind of the generic, hey, let me know if you need anything, it's not that helpful, because it just puts more pressure on the person grieving. So that's just a few thoughts, but there's a lot of trying to compare your story of grief with ours, especially in the early stages, isn't helpful. So saying, you know, I also lost my pet earlier this year, and so I understand what you're going through. It's just like, it's not helpful, right? So comparison stories, like, it's more just, you know, tell me about the person or just a little, I'm thinking about you, I love you. Little notes to say that you care about the person. And again, even just asking about the loved one that was lost, if you didn't know that, like, it's meaningful for us. Even if we would be tearing up as we do it, it's meaningful for us to tell people about Jude. And that's why when we can, we like to take the opportunities to tell people about him.
That is Jamie Strickland. Jamie, you and your family are remarkable, let me tell you. And father of Jude, you've been reading, everyone's been reading about Jude for over a year now. That's the guy who, that's the father right there. Jamie, really appreciate the time today. Thank you for doing this.
All right. My pleasure.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
The world is full of tough news these days, but we have some good news. I mean, it's in the grand scheme of things, you know, it's not the end of a war, but it can still be something positive that we can look forward to. And that is that, well, the battle, we won't say a war, that would be to diminish the real war. The battle that was between the players and the owners in baseball is finally over. Players are back on the field at spring training, and we are getting close to actual real baseball. And better than that, even, the Blue Jays make a huge trade today. And now, I mean, just so many of the experts who I'm reading about and looking at online and listening to everywhere, now saying, you know what? The Jays are kind of the team to beat. I'm always a little reluctant to go down that path because that seems to be guaranteed to cause a jinx. Nonetheless, let me bring in Mike Wilner, very familiar radio voice, now writing for the Toronto Star on the Blue Jays. He joins us. Mike, how are you tonight?
Pretty good, thanks. Just putting this latest episode of Deep Left Field to bed tonight. So it'll be out tomorrow, live from spring training, so everybody can get a chance to hear what a lot of these Blue Jays think about Matt Chapman.
And what, I mean, I read something today. I think it was the manager was saying that there were a lot of smiles in the clubhouse when that news came out today. Is that what you heard from people?
You know, it broke at about 8:15, 8:30. So we were in the clubhouse as the Blue Jays were getting ready for the day's work. It was supposed to rain, so all the outside stuff was canceled, and then it didn't rain. But yeah, they were pretty excited, and in speaking to you know, a bunch of them, they used words like awesome and huge, and it's an amazing acquisition. This guy has he might be the best defensive player in the game right now. It's going to be so much fun to watch.
Well, and look, the last time the Blue Jays made a trade with Oakland for a third baseman, it turned out reasonably well, as I recall.
Yeah, I don't think Matt Chapman's going to win the MVP. I don't think we should be looking for that sort of contribution like Josh Donaldson made for the Jays in 2015. But there's, I mean, he could show up literally without a bat and still be a plus for this team.
One of the funny things, because he has played on the West Coast, and it happens in baseball all the time, that there are guys out there, and like a lot of Blue Jays fans knew about Josh Donaldson before he came, to use that name again, but didn't know just how good Josh Donaldson was. I think the same thing is probably the case for Chapman. I think people have heard of him. People who play in a fantasy league certainly know about him. But I think there's going to be, would you agree, there's going to be an awful lot of people who don't know a whole ton about him and are going to have their eyes opened a bit.
Oh, yeah, I think so, too. And even a lot of those fantasy league-type people, because fantasy leagues are offense-dependent, right? So they'll know that, oh, he hit 230 last year, or he's a career 243 hitter, he strikes out a lot, and he's got some pop. So that's what they know about Matt Chapman. They don't know that he's Brooks Robinson. And you know, for people who aren't in their 50s and 60s, yeah, Brooks Robinson is maybe the greatest defensive third baseman in history. It's going to be, I mean, go to YouTube, look up some highlights. It's amazing. The things he does defensively are amazing.
There has been, last year, one of the areas of some consternation, Bo Bichette is still a very young player, but the one area of consternation with him was his defense. How much does bringing a guy in who's a gold glove third baseman and has the range of Chapman, how much does that make life easier on Bichette and maybe solve some of those problems or at least cover them up?
Bo Bichette no longer has to worry about anything hit to his right. Like, legitimately does not have to worry about it. If it's hit to his right, that's fine. Matt Chapman will take care of it. Work on balls that are hit at you. Work on balls that are hit to your left and up the middle. And you'll be great. He may never have to make another backhand play as long as Chapman is here. It sounds like I'm overstating, but it's quite possible that that's true. It's going to help Bo tremendously. And, you know, Chapman has enough arm, too, that he can play deep, which just increases his range that much more. So the Blue Jays have all kinds of fun options now with the defense on the left side of the infield.
And
so good.
And better yet, I had heard that yesterday there were sightings of Vladdy Guerrero at third taking ground balls. This theoretically or presumably removes that from having to be an option.
For any sort of length of time, absolutely. I mean, as long as Chapman can stay on the field, which is something that, you know, he's actually been quite good at doing over the course of his career. And I think that Major league teams, and you know, you look for those little edges to help you win. They're now understanding that durability is a tool. It's a thing. And Chapman has played 145 games or more in every one of his full seasons in the major leagues. So he can be counted on to post, as they say. And so, yeah, it one would assume they're not going to have to think about using Vlad at third all that much.
The one thing that I will, I think we're going to have to create, you know, some people have a swear jar. We're going to have a wrong name jar for every time someone accidentally, at the beginning especially, because I've already seen it, refers to him as Mark Chapman. Very different guy.
Wow,
it's,
yeah.
Yeah, let's not get that name confused, but it has happened already. It's Matt Chapman that is the new third baseman for the Blue Jays.
Yeah, not Mark David Chapman, Matt Chapman.
Yeah, let's... I laughed already a couple times seeing a few tweets of that one. It's like, no, I think you might want to go back and check that one. The irony of this as well is that this happens the same week within, 24 hours of, we talk about Josh Donaldson joining the Yankees. I mean, it's been an interesting few days in the third base world in the American League.
It's been an interesting few days, like, all over the place. This is, it's, you know, we're here at spring training, but it's also the winter meetings, because teams weren't able to make any moves for 99 days over the course of the off season. So, you know, in the last half hour, Chris Bryant signed a 7-year, $182 million deal with Colorado. Jock Peterson just signed with San Francisco. This afternoon, Kyle Schwarber signed with the Phillies. All kinds of stuff is going on. So it's just a blast. It's hot stove season here in Florida.
I want to get to the other Jays' big move from the other day, but just before we do, I do want to talk about Oakland for a sec. What is the connection between the Jays and Oakland? It seems like any time there is, well, every season it seems there's at least one trade between these teams, but anytime there's a big trade, it seems it's the Jays and Oakland. Is it just a fluke, or is there something within these two organizations that they just feel they work well together, or what's the background there?
Well, I think anytime you've got a trading partner who there's trust there and who you know, and that sort of thing grows deal to deal. Now, obviously, the Josh Donaldson trade was made by a completely different front office than the one that made this trade. But there are, you know, there are teams that like to make moves, and there are teams that don't like to make moves. And when you get a couple of teams that like to make moves together, then making moves winds up being a pretty easy thing to do. When, you know, when you trust each other, when you need something, when they need something, you can hammer something out if you value the player in the same way that they do. So you know, off the top of my head, I can't really think of a whole big, huge pattern of big Blue Jays and Oakland deals, but they're two front offices who look at things similarly, who like to make moves, and there's nothing stopping them.
Then you've got the move with Kikuchi, the pitcher coming in, and again, West Coast team, played in Seattle. So again, a lot of unfamiliarity in a lot of cases. What are the Jays getting with him?
It's a good question. You know, they're getting a guy who was an all-star, who was basically unhittable for the first half of last season, and then who, after the all-star break, was so bad that he lost his job down the stretch. The Mariners took him out of the rotation the last week and a half, when they were gunning for that wild card spot. He throws really, really hard, and he gets hit really, really hard. He's like in the top percentile of opponents' exit velocity in the majors last season, and not in a good way. So what Kikuchi has to do is work with Pete Walker and Matt Bushman and the whole coaching staff and figure out how to get back to doing what he did in the first part of the season last year, because he's got, I mean, everything you could possibly want. He throws hard. He's got an incredible breaking ball. and he's got solid command, he's, and there's no pressure on him, right? He's the fifth starter on this team. So there's a whole lot to like there, but he hasn't been able to really put it together enough in the big leagues yet.
You mentioned Pete Walker. This is a guy who, in the last year or two, I mean, he's been with the Jays for a while, but in the last year or two, it seems that there's this legend of Pete Walker that has really taken hold, that Pete Walker is the pitcher whisperer, that Pete Walker can fix anybody, that Pete Walker can get everyone straightened out. Do you buy this legend of Pete Walker? I mean, he's a good pitching coach, obviously. Is there something beyond that that you buy into?
I don't think there's any magic. You know, there have been players who have come here who haven't succeeded once Pete gets his hands on them. But I do think he's a really, really smart guy. I think he connects very, very well with his pitchers, and I think he knows what he's doing. And, you know, when you've got all those things and you've got a willing student, then really good things can happen. You know, there are a lot of coaches. A lot of coaches deliver the same message to players, but every one of them delivers it in a different way. So the question is, does it get through or does it not? And with Pete, with a lot of the guys he deals with, it seems to get through more often than not. And he's got a great eye for things, for little fixes, and he works very well with his pitchers. And, you know, I think he's to the extent that a coach can help turn a player around, Pete Walker is one of the guys you really want to have trying to do it.
So, as I said off the top, the Jays have now added one huge name, one potentially really good name. They had a lineup that was very good last year. They had a pitching staff that was good and improving last year. A number of people now, and I'm talking people who are supposed to know what they're talking about in the game of baseball, saying the Jays are the team that they're watching for. Is that a fair assessment of what these Toronto Blue Jays are right now going into the season? Should they be a prohibitive favorite in the American League or AL East or wild card team? Or where do you see this team right now?
I don't see a team in the league that's better. I really don't. I mean, when you look at the changes they made starting at the deadline last year and moving in, right? They added Jose Berríos. They had a Cy Young Award winner in Robbie Ray. They replaced him with Kevin Gausman. They've added Matt Chapman. The Blue Jays, from the trade deadline on last year, were 40-23. That's a 103 win pace. They may not have gotten better from that point, but they have made sure that they're at least very close to as good. They didn't lose Marcus Semien. They've replaced him with Chapman, who does different things. He's not going to hit 45 home runs, but now you have potentially a healthy Kevin Biggio. So I think that you know, Biggio and Chapman combined will do what Semien and the bunch of nobodies who played third base for the Blue Jays did combined. Plus you add that defense and Chapman and you take a whole crap load of runs away. So yeah, hopefully they're not done. They could still use a better DH, preferably left-handed. There are fewer and fewer options now. Again, the Jock Peterson just signed. Corey Dickerson is still out there, and he helped him last year. He could help him again. Freddie Freeman is still out there. Who knows what's going to happen there? That would be unbelievable. But yeah, right now they absolutely, I think, should be the prohibitive favorites in the American League, not just in the AL East.
Yeah, Freddie Freeman is that. I mean, way before Chapman was really on the radar. I mean, it's been the Freddie Freeman discussion for the last number of days about whether he was coming, and because he's Canadian or partially Canadian, or there's elements of Canadian in him. I don't know how you word it, but there was talk that the Blue Jays were a landing spot here or the Dodgers. I mean, could you honestly, with the money they've spent and what they have to spend going forward in the next couple of years with Bichette and with Guerrero, could you honestly see them still being interested?
I think they're still interested. Yeah. And, you know, there have been reports today, though some from dubious sources, that Freeman's team is sort of fearing that he's overplayed his hand by demanding that sixth year, not signing with the Braves, and now seeing, you know, the Yankees sign Anthony Rizzo and the Blue Jays trade for Chapman, and some of these doors are closing. It makes me wonder if Freeman says at some point, you know what, let's just take a one-year deal and go back on the market next year. And if he does that, then give him $35 million and bring him to Toronto. Let's go.
Yeah, no, that's if that were to happen, boy, I mean, I think there's a lot of Blue Jay fans that are already pretty excited. And the amazing part about this, we got to run. The amazing part about this, it was not that long ago that there were an awful lot of people who really, really, really hated the brain trust of the Blue Jays. I mean, couldn't stand them. And of course, they came in after Alex Anthopoulos, but there was a hatred there. And that seems to be softening a little. The things seem to be looking a little better now. And suddenly, Mark Shapiro, not quite as, and Ross Atkins, not quite as disliked. Things seem to be turning a little bit. And you know what? A lot of excitement. So, you know, we will see, but this team does look pretty darn good. I'll say that on paper.
It does, but remember, you know, you can't win the pennant in March, so the games absolutely still have to be played. And I know you said we got to run, but before you do, just let me shout out an old colleague of mine, Jamie Campbell of Sportsnet, who announced on Twitter last hour that he's currently being treated for chronic lymphocytic leukemia. So, make sure everybody sends Jamie their best, and we'll all have his back in this fight.
Absolutely. We've had Jamie on this show many times and did not know that. And that's absolutely. Thank you for letting us know that. That is rough. We will be thinking about Jamie for sure. Mike Wilner, thank you for the time today. Really appreciate this.
All right, anytime.
The Scott Radley Show. Weekday evenings from 6 to 8 on 900 CHML.
The Scott Radley Show podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Scott Radley. Thanks again for listening, and do not forget to subscribe to this podcast. It is free. You will never miss an episode. And also, be sure you rate us and review us. Whatever you think of us, we'll take it. Thanks for listening.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone. Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.